All right, welcome back to those of you who are joining us. Now we have Ari here, joined by our special guest, Christopher Penn, who is the co-founder and chief data scientist at Trust Insights. So I'm going to hand this over to you guys. I'm sure this is going to be a very good conversation about AI.
Thank you, Victoria. Chris, great to see you again.
Thanks for having me. It's fun to hang out and stuff.
Exactly. Last time we were together, we were talking about smart search, and I'd love to get some of your insights on where we could go with this product. For everybody that's listening, I'll just kind of recap what we've done with smart search, and then if we can explore the future of how smart search could grow, that would really be selfishly beneficial for me, Chris. I'm going to get some free consulting here. So with Smart Search, we released the Zeus release just last week. And what Smart Search does is it takes you from the old world of searching with keywords when you're searching for a product on a commerce website to concept and image search capabilities. And the thought process that we have is that humans have trained themselves to dumb down the way that they find products to be able to interact with computers, where we think, oh, I'm going to go camping, I'm going hiking, I need hiking boots, I'm going to search for waterproof hiking boots. As opposed to if we went into a REI outfitter's store, we would go to the sales rep and say, hey, we're going camping, and wait for the sales rep to give us a whole big list. You need camping poles, and you need a canteen, and you need boots, and so forth. And Smart Search brings that experience to the website, where instead of stating what you need, you just state what your plans are, what you're going to do, and it figures it out. What we also did with image search was we took that to the next level with images, so that, for instance, if you are working on an engine, you could just pull open your phone and take a picture of that image of that engine, and it would list out all of the parts that are in there and see if you needed to replace some of those. You might not even know the name of the part. And all of this is around creating more of a human experience. I'd love to hear from you, Chris, where you see that going in the future, what technologies we should be considering. Let's get some thoughts going.
So it's interesting. You're talking about multimodality, right? You're talking about blending things like images, video, and text together. And what's interesting is that multimodality is sort of blurring the lines about what a language model is good at versus what a multimodal model is capable of. So for those unfamiliar, a language model is like the ones that power tools like ChatGPT. You talk to it, it tells you stuff, gives you mediocre blog posts if you're not skilled at prompting, the usual sort of thing there. With multimodal, it's here's an image, describe it, or here's a picture of my fridge, what can I cook for dinner tonight, things like that. And one of the challenges that a lot of folks are running into is distinguishing and differentiating what is a language query that a language model can handle versus what's symbolic. What is a symbolic query where it's not language? So here's an example. Let's say you are shopping for, say, hiking boots, like use your example. A symbolic query, a symbolic association would be, hey, when people buy this item, they also tend to buy these items, right? It doesn't really matter what the items are. There's a statistical association. If you buy hiking boots, you're probably also going to buy hiking poles. You're also probably going to buy a tent, right? And that sort of forms the classical recommendation engine. If you go on any major e-commerce store, you always get the list of here's the other things that are associated with it. But then you also have other types of symbology. So you take your significant other to the local camping store, and you're there, and your significant other goes, oh, I love that color, that's great. And you're like, that, we're not even buying that. Like, that's not even on the list. That's really like going boating. We don't even have a boat. But that's a symbolic thing where a person has a preference towards the appearance of something, even if it's not functionally part of the query. So part of advancing, I would call it intuitive search, is incorporating things that are language-based, right? Because, and you'll have things like, hey, if I'm going camping, what do I need? Well, you should have a campfire. And that's from our use of language to say, like, yeah, I went camping last week, I couldn't get the fire started. And language models understand that from the words we use, combined with imagery, combined with the classical recommendation systems, combined with user preferences about things like color or shape or texture. And all of those modalities, as models become more multimodal, will eventually converge to a point where an AI engine can say, okay, well, here's the things I think you're going to like. Some of them are based on language. Some of them are based on image. Some of them are based on function. And the really smart companies will have to invest a lot of money and a lot of horsepower to build these models that are capable of those different types of search all under one umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because when you think about how the matching happens on this search and generative versus discriminative matching algorithms, when you're bringing in all of these different modalities, you almost fall into a spot where the generative model becomes much easier to implement because you just have this space and everything that can fall into that hypersphere, for instance, can land in there as opposed to needing to know all of the modalities, which you might not know, have examples of each of them to generate statistics across each one, which you might not have enough examples to do reliably across these different models. And I think that's really where a lot of this is happening at the lower level.
Exactly. And one of the things that, you know, retailers in particular will have to struggle with is different modalities on a per consumer basis. Some people like whatever I buy has to go with my look, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. That's their thing. Like I have this one friend who hot pink is their thing. Like that is, they will buy any product that is that shade of pink. It's like, why'd you buy that's a crane. You bought a crane. Why did you buy a crane? Because, you know, it was the right color. Other people would be like, I am all about functionality. I don't care how it looks, but it's got to be the most durable camping tent ever made. It's got to be bulletproof, right? And so a vendor who is working on an intelligent, intuitive search has to have internally different weights that vary based on the human being that they're doing the shopping with, because it has to align with your preferences if it's going to guess correctly.
Right, right, right. Now, at some point, and I don't think it's going to be very far away, the standard for shopping online is going to migrate away from going to a website and looking for that search dialogue and even entering, you know, a concept rather than a keyword or dragging an image into something that is more interactive, more agent-like, and maybe agents interacting with agents. What are your thoughts in terms of where we're heading from the shopping experience?
We are there in some ways already. Like, a lot of people have smart speakers at home, right? They say, hey, Siri, or hey, whoever, buy me this thing. I have a bunch from Amazon, and they're always trying to sell me something. Like, every day, like, hey, there's a sale on this. I'm like, okay. So we have that in a very primitive sense. But what is happening in the agent ecosystem in AI is fascinating, and we're seeing sort of two different paths. One is sort of a purpose-built agent where you sit down with a tool like Microsoft AutoGen or LangChain or Crew.ai, and you say, I'm going to build an agent that will serve this specific function. I want an agent that's going to go shopping for me and find, build me a short list of vendors itself, technical hydrogen peroxide at concentration 30% or more. And it will talk and write its own code to do that. And then you're also going to have the big general agent. So this is something that we're already seeing. Apple has released a number of components over the last 3 months that very strongly hint which direction they are going. They are going to turn Siri into a context-aware language model that is a broad, generalized assistive agent. And what makes their implementation fascinating is that Siri can listen to what you're saying, right, as you're talking to it. It can process information that it has from the language model it's being trained on, but it can see your screen. So it can see what you're looking at right now on screen, whether you're in someone's shopping app, whether you're in Apple Music, whatever. And because of that, when you look at the papers they've released, they're saying, we understand better the context of what someone's trying to do based on what Siri can see from your screen. So imagine you've got your iPhone open, you're on someone's website, you're doing some shopping. Siri can see what you're shopping for now and can start to make recommendations.
That is amazing. Wow. So you don't need to be Google where you know what IPs are being hit and so forth. It's actually completely passively monitoring that, you know, Safari instance.
Mm-hmm. Boy. Yep.
Yeah. So, right. All right. So this is where Apple is going, where they're context aware. They can passively monitor your activity and have better, you know, whatever, shopping, more intuitive shopping. And what is Google, Facebook, and Microsoft's plan? How are these guys approaching?
Well, as of the day we're recording this, today is I think it's day 2 of Google Cloud Next, and they've already announced, to no one's surprise, Gemini, it's their language model, is in everything. They are cramming that into as many places as they possibly can, trying to make it do as many things as it possibly can. They just released a new image generation module for it. And of course, one of the things I thought was fascinating was they said Gemini now has founding, which basically says, according to the technical notes, every time Gemini comes up with something, it is going to refer to Google search catalog and say, we're going to check to make sure that is a foundation of truth in Gemini based on search. No surprise, companies like Perplexity and Microsoft's Bing have been doing this for a while. Google's catching up in some ways. But what that means for anyone who is selling something online, you have got to be really good at Google search. You've got to be good at SEO. You've got to be good at accessibility and all of the things that Google says to be good at, because now, in addition to traditional search, the AI model itself is going to be looking at Google search catalog and saying, hey, here's what I think I know about you. So your Google shopping metadata, your schema data, all that stuff that makes for a great product catalog in today's world of basic search is feeding the ground truth for their AI. So is this
how they're doing RAG on top of an LLM with like real-time index of the whole internet being their foundation?
Yes. So Google and Meta and a few other companies. In fact, Google and Meta are probably the two companies that are best positioned to do truly good multimodal models, because they have, over the last 25 years, persuaded users to give them ridiculous amounts of data. And companies like OpenAI are struggling to catch up. Like OpenAI is trying to buy data in as many places as it can. Google's like, well, hey, I have your last 20 years of photos from your Google Photos account, and I have every video I've ever watched from YouTube, so I don't need a whole lot of other data.
Yeah, right, that. And every email that you've written in Gmail, too.
Uh-huh. There is a reason why. I mean, Google was late to the game on a lot of this stuff, and they've been scrambling and pushing really hard, but they have that nearly unassailable database that only really Meta has more data. I mean, Meta has, you know, the last 20 years of your Facebook account and your Instagram account and your WhatsApp and your Oculus and all and this, that. There aren't many companies that have that much training data that they have a license to use.
Yes. And where does Microsoft sit in all of this?
So Microsoft is an interesting case because they've put a lot of investment, obviously, into the OpenAI ecosystem, but also they also have a fair amount of data. However, one of the interesting things about them is that they've been faster about integrating the data they have. So they were early with getting the GPT-4 model to talk to the Bing database, right? They were early enough that people were like, actually, Bing is useful now. They've been early on OpenAI stuff. And last year, when of course the whole kerfuffle about, you know, Sam Altman happened, Microsoft was basically the ones that said, "We pay 51% of your bills, so you're going to do as you're told." They were a big part of that. They're also releasing code like crazy. I mean, they are publishing tons of open source. But at the end of the day, Microsoft's reach doesn't quite rival Google's and Meta's, because Microsoft, to their credit, has been very good about protecting users' data, right? And mm-hmm. not saying, hey, we're going to just borrow every data piece of you know information you've ever written in Microsoft Office to train our models. They don't do that, and they, you know, that comes at a cost for them.
Yeah. I feel like Google was doing that from day one, and they may not have had LLMs in their mind, but they did see the value of data and have used it in various ways to now where it's really, really gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So In terms of video, you know, now things, you know, become an order of magnitude more expensive to be able to manage. And these LLMs, and NVIDIA is going to be making tremendous amounts of chips and money as we start processing, you know, video. I've heard these stories about nuclear power plants and how countries are going to, countries practically are going to be able to manage this. Where is all of this going in terms of being able to manage that amount of processing?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. So Microsoft was the company that said, we need to build a nuclear reactor for one of our Redmond data centers because we can't get enough power otherwise. They're also looking at the cooling issue. They just pioneered the first deep sea underwater data center for this because they can't cool these data centers down fast enough. They consume so much water there that some data centers are actually impacting drinking water supplies because the machines just need that much cooling. So these are all issues that are at a hardware level are becoming challenging. One of Google's announcements today was Axion is going to be their first ARM-based chip that will be tuned for AI, and they're saying we got to create our own. We can't, you know, we're not able to power the Intel chips that we're using. Apple is way ahead of the game on this one. Apple's M series architecture really is ideally tuned for AI, and they know it. And then that's why like the top end MacBooks cost so much, because like, hey, you can use this thing to train really big models at home. And that's why your laptop costs $5,000 now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then everyone's got to start tapping into that laptop when it's not being used and hit that CPU for some extra processing.
Exactly. I am honestly surprised that no one has gone like the SETI at home route, you know, from back in way back in the day, and said, hey, can we use your CPU at night when you're not using it? And we'll pay you, you know, 2 cents an hour or whatever for it. I'm honestly surprised that no one has a company that has scaled that up yet.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, funny SETI at home, when I first started my first company, and we still had servers in the closet and so forth. I remember one of my engineers like had all of our servers pegged on a SETI at home one night, and our customers were unhappy with the performance of their site.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it. If you had intelligent, truly intelligent device management, we all have like these things. I mean, this is a supercomputer. This is like an A17 Bionic chip in here. What is it doing most of the time? Nothing. It's sitting in my pocket.
Right.
If companies, and I would expect a company like Apple to be, you know, in the forefront of this, if companies said, okay, hey, we know there is, you know, 90% of the world's compute is sitting on your desk doing nothing at the moment, maybe we can harness it instead of building, you know, ridiculously massive data centers and you know, chewing up even more electricity. Why that's not happening yet, I don't know.
Right. And here's the business model. What you do is you say, hey, listen, you've got a Verizon bill of $200 a month, and we're going to give you credit for using your phone every night of whatever, $1 a night that I get to bang your phone from midnight to 6 a.m., and people will jump all over it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you just just remember to plug it in and stuff so that your phone doesn't die at 2 a.m. But no, that would be the sensible thing. So going back to the agents, so that is the big agent. The individual person is going to have essentially a personal assistant. Like we will all have a personal assistant probably on our phones. And then the business side of things, businesses that are clever and smart will get agents deployed on their digital properties sooner rather than later, so that if you go to, you know, Walmart's website, they have a seller's agent there that can assist you with the purchase process if you don't maybe have a phone that can support this, and so you can shop that way. Where I think there'll be an interesting thing is it'll almost kind of look like real estate, where you'll have the buyer's agent, the seller's agent. They'll be able to talk to each other and you know, negotiate. So the buyer's agent's like, okay, I'm going to try and buy this bottle of bleach. I'm going to go to five different vendors, who's got the best price and free shipping and stuff, and negotiate that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can totally see that happening. And this multi-agent universe will have all sorts of emergent properties, right? You'll have social norms that develop where agents will trust other agents that behave a certain way and spend more, you know, cycles processing their requests than agents that just, you know, don't follow the proper norms and therefore are less trustworthy.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, I mean, you're going to have a massive industry of cybersecurity, right? Like, this agent has a signed certificate and is trustworthy. This agent is not trustworthy, and so on and so forth.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the agents also on the buy side will be able to be efficient in terms of which payment methods they'll use. They'll be able to scour for coupons, use your credit card that gives the proper amount of points and so forth for different purchases. And it'll very much change where the agents ultimately should be able to anticipate many, not all, of your monthly needs and be ahead of all that. And then your more whimsical stuff, you'll ask the agent to take care of, but you'll always be milk in your fridge.
Exactly. And the thing that I would tell companies that you can do today to get ready, like right now, today, this is the easiest thing in the world. It's not easy, but it's the most simple, straightforward thing in the world. Go to ibm.com/able or any of the other major companies that offer accessibility tools. If your site and your shopping catalog and all stuff functions with a screen reader today for someone who's visually impaired, it will function well with AI agents tomorrow, right? So if you want to get ready for this today, get your site up to accessibility standards for visually impaired people right now. And you can do that. It will cost you HTML, right? There are existing compliance standards. There are tools. IBM has a whole bunch of free tools for doing this that cost nothing, and you can validate your site works and you know with screen readers and things. And it's going to make it easy for those buyer's agents to parse and understand your shopping cart, your site, your catalog. Out of the gate, you'll be well ahead of everyone else. And also, by the way, the 15 to 20% of people who have a visual impairment, you're going to help them shop better today.
Right, right. And you'll avoid a frivolous lawsuit for not being ADA compliant while you're at it.
Exactly.
But are there standards like schema.org or standard APIs that are emerging and winning the race for agent access to shopping sites?
Not right now. Not right now, because it's still too young. It's still too new. So yeah. Section 508, which is the U.S. government's accessibility standard, is probably the easiest one to get up and running with. It's well-defined. It's years old at this point. The Perkins Accessibility Project for the Perkins School for the Blind also has a lot of great standards and stuff that's available. But in terms of other basic protocols, most agents today are written in Python. So and use standard Python libraries like the JSON library, argparse, and all that stuff. So if you have systems and software that have REST APIs and things like that, yeah, you're well positioned.
Right. I've always been disappointed with how we failed to really do a very good job at the separation of content and presentation with HTML and CSS and so forth. And JSON has become kind of a standard, and that is a separation if your CSS isn't too messy and so forth. But I would be hopeful that CMSs ultimately are publishing the content for each web page itself in a way that is accessible to Google and to these agents. But I think ultimately a more efficient version of the internet for agents will emerge in addition to the visual one that humans work with, or there'll be better separation between content and visual so that they can interact. And then you all of a sudden you have agents that are living on this internet and doing your shopping for you.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, systems like a headless CMS essentially do that already, right? They separate the presentation layer from the data layer. And at this point, if you've already gone that route anyway, then your data layer can have API connectors that will let an agent talk to the data directly and just bypass the presentation layer. One of the things that Google has said in their search podcast is, HTML is such a hot mess that when they are deploying their robots, they have a whole set of algorithms just for trying to clean up HTML and have it be less of a mess for indexing, which I found fascinating. If you can reduce that burden for both agents and for Google, guess what? You will also rank better in search, right? So a lot of this stuff is stuff that you can do today to get ready for tomorrow, but also helps you today also.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great point. I'm actually, when I hear that about Google, it makes a ton of sense, right? I mean, it's reducing their cycles. If they can get a set of heuristics, they're just going to notice certain bad patterns of HTML and have a technique for cleaning that up, getting out of it and pulling the content. However, this thing that Apple is doing is really interesting, because rather than looking at the HTML, they're actually taking this hands-off approach at looking at the screen, which you really need an LLM or some other sort of, you know, system, this convolutional network or whatever, to be able to interpret that, because that's vision.
It's vision. And if you read the paper, it's actually a multimodal model. And what's fascinating about it is that they've trained it on a lot of their own internal data. It turns out that, for example, they have, I don't know what, 10 years, 15 years of all the dumb things we've asked Siri.
Yeah.
And they fine-tune their model to basically handle 95% of the queries that Siri has failed at, right? So like, hey, I want to do this and this and this. So even though their model is relatively small, I mean, I think it's like the equivalent of like a 4 billion parameter model. It is not a big model at all. It is hyper-tuned to 15 years worth of Siri usage. So they've, you know, every time you talk to Siri, you know it's generating a log entry in Cupertino. And as a result, they took the smart approach. Instead of trying to train a massive model on everything, train a model on what people already use it for and the things it does wrong, and make sure that it does those well. And, you know, 95% of your users will be happy.
This is a lot of information. Now, you're out there working with businesses that some of them are just struggling to keep up. Other ones are doing more innovative stuff and they're at the cutting edge. What are like some of the things that, you know, that people as computer scientists or businesses need to have on their radar to keep up with this super fast-paced world here?
Keeping up with it is a full-time job. It really is. I keep an eye on a lot of the different academic paper sites, the archive, you know, archive.org, for example, that look at what's being published, particularly from reputable companies like Google and Apple, what's coming out of their labs. I follow their developer blogs. I go to like the LinkedIn engineering blog. It's funny. People will talk about the LinkedIn algorithm and stuff. And like, no, the developers have published exactly how it works. They've even given you technical examples. They're very clear about it. It's just that most marketers don't know how to read code. Pay attention to a lot of those things. Have a good community around you of people who are also following this stuff, who can, you know, say like, hey, I found this. I have one friend who works at a government agency who's like, oh yeah, we're looking at this, this, and this. I'm like, okay, are you allowed to tell me that? Like, yeah, well, I'm allowed to tell you we're looking at it. I'm not telling you what we're using it for, but but I'll tell you what we're looking at. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. So these are all the ways that I pay attention to stuff, but there is so much happening.
Yeah, it's really overwhelming. Are there any particular industries, not computer industries, but, you know, whatever, manufacturing segments or so forth, that you see as doing a good job at trying to keep up with this?
You know, big tech is the industry that where obviously a lot of this stuff comes from. So it's where you'll see the most interesting edge cases of how it's being used. Most regular companies are still trying to figure out what to do with ChatGPT, right? They're like, hey, there's this thing called AI. We should do something with it. Let's write more blog posts with it, which is fine, right? If that's where you are, that's where you are. And it's not something to be ashamed of. But where the technology is going and stuff, and how fast it's happening, you really have to look at the tech sector itself just to see what people are trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What we've run into in a couple of different side industries is executives coming to us and saying, you know what, I got to do something with AI. And it's like, well, that's not very great, you know, way to approach the world. But okay, we'll help you. Let's, you know, talk about some of the things that we that we can do together. But the one industry that we're very active in, or industry segment, is on the B2B side, is distributors and distributors in construction materials, specialists in plumbing supplies, specialists in electrical and so forth. And I've been very happy to see great interest in how those execs can improve their space, because quite frankly, those guys were way behind the curve on just regular old, you know, online catalogs and so forth. And they still have a huge way to go. But I over the past month, I've been really happy at the amount of inbound requests from those industries themselves to say, just help us find something that we can do. Is there value here?
The thing that I think is worth looking at and asking about is asking a company how much data they have. Right. So the success or failure of a company in AI, it comes down to two things, right? Number one, the quality and quantity of data you have. And number two, the quality and quantity of good ideas that you have. If you have smart people who are very creative, they will find use cases for AI that you're not thinking about, and they will find a way to bring it to life. But if you have the data that is the raw material to make any model function better, you will succeed faster. You'll get to market faster. And so no matter what industry, every industry is going to have, you know, the top 5% who are leaders and the 95% who are laggards. Those 5% who are the leaders, if they've got the data, they can win faster or secure their position in the industry. And if in that same industry, if there's 5% people who've got the data who are not the leaders, they have an opportunity for a substantial opportunity for disruption right now, because the leaders are asleep. And the challengers are like, hey, we got this data and we can build a model around this. Let's go.
That is, I think, a great rule of thumb, heuristic. If you're an executive in an industry where you have huge amounts of data, and huge doesn't have to be, you know, petabytes, but if you've got more data than your team can handle and more data than most of your competitors have, this is an area we should start thinking about what's going on with AI right now and find ways to pull even farther ahead of your competition.
I love it. And I want to say this is probably the perfect place to pause. Christopher, thank you so much for really making a very complicated subject matter quite a bit more concrete. I know I heard pretty consistently throughout your guys' conversations some ways for people to get started. Especially if, you know, a lot of companies, like Ari, you mentioned, they might be pretty far behind on how to utilize AI, what to do with all their data. So I think this is a great conversation, really beneficial information. Christopher, can you just share where people can find you at if they want to learn more about what you do specifically?
Sure. The easiest place to go with all the things that are out there is the website, trustinsights.ai. And from there, you can find anything you want.
Wonderful. And I know you didn't mention this, but I personally have been subscribed to your newsletter for some time, and it is phenomenal. So if anyone does go to your site, I would recommend checking out the newsletter. Just a lot of the content that you covered today, it's broken down very nicely. So well done on that newsletter. But I wanted to thank you both for just a phenomenal episode. We'll be sharing this in a couple of weeks, and then we'll include the link to trustinsights.ai in the show notes as well. So thank you both, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.